It's Monday, June 10th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The Donald Trump vice presidential slot was Kristi Noem's to lose, and she lost it in a big way.
I have a great life. She gets me so many toys. She even got me one of those dog button mats you can press to talk. Check it out. You could say run or hungry. It's super fun. Look, ready?
She is going to kill me.
Next up, we hear talk of J.D. Vance, Tim Scott, Tom Cotton. But if you thought Noem's former dog, Cricket, was the explanation for her aborted status, it is also the reaction to one of the supposed top names on the list, Doug Burgum. Yes, that Doug Burgum. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, Doug Mentum, loves extracting fossil fuels and natural gas. Dig, Doug, dig. Vice President? I mean, here's a guy with Secretary of Energy written all over
him. This whole idea of, oh, I've been invoked, and then it ping-pongs back and forth, and then you're another 30-minute segment's gone by. You know, it's not... It's
not really repository of energy or inspirer of energy, but cabinet position. Secretary of Energy. He is Secretary of Energy energy. It's not an insult for Doug Burgum. How would Trump pick such an empty suit, even if it's an empty matching suit with Vivek Ramaswamy and other assorted Trump lackeys who showed up to support the former president during his criminal trial? I'll give you a reason for the Doug Mentum. In fact, I'll give you 100 million of them. No, that is not the amount of votes he will win. It is his net worth, or at least his net worth, according to Forbes. I've always been suspicious, by the way, of the dollar denomination of reasons. Like if Doug Burgum travels a few miles north and becomes Canadian and converts his currency, would I then not give you 100 million, but 138 million reasons in Canadian reasons at current rates? You know, if he converts his reasons to Turkish lira, it'll be 3.2 billion reasons to pick Doug Burgum. But now, said to be in Trump's sights, is Doug's fortune, which according to Forbes is a bit lower than Steve Forbes, according to Fortune. I would say the other candidates might just have one move left. It was a move pioneered by RFK Jr.'s running mate, Nicole Shanahan. They're each going to have to try to marry and quickly divorce a co-founder of Google. Get on that, Tim Scott, J.D. Vance, Elise Stefanik. I know you're all married. I know Larry Page is too, but we all need to debase ourselves a little to get in good with the big guy, and if all goes well, his supporters won't even call for your execution by the time the gig ends. On the show today, Israel rescues four, takes incoming for the toll of doing so. But first, Lawrence Wood is a highly decorated attorney, and more importantly to him and for our purposes, the 8-time winner of the New Yorker Comic Caption Contest. He's really thought out how to win the New Yorker Comic Caption Contest. He's become an expert on New Yorker captions. He is the author of the new book, Your Caption Has Been Selected. He will divulge his recipe for humor. Lawrence Wood, up next. Lawrence Wood is a brilliant and accomplished individual who lists his credits in a weird way. In reverse, he is the, and this is just how his bio goes, the third thing it says is that he is the supervising attorney at Legal Action Chicago. This is an extremely organization that helps thousands of people just live their lives and survive. He's also, and for more than 20 years, has been a lecturer in law at the University of Chicago Law School. I don't know, some would say the third best law school in America. But here's the number one credit and why we're talking to him, which is an indictment of us. Lawrence Wood has been a finalist in the New Yorker cartoon caption, a record-setting 15 times and won 8 contests. And in fact, I don't know, Maybe he's written books and treatises on the law, but we didn't have him on for that. We had him on for his book. Your caption has been selected more than anyone could possibly want to know about the New Yorker Cartoon Caption Contest. Hello, Mr. Professor and cartoonist or cartoon captionist Wood.
Hello, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Am I right? Have you written other real books, by the way?
I have not written other real books, no. I've written a lot of briefs. I've written resource manuals, yeah. Not intentionally funny.
What do you think when judges try to be funny? Like put a little, some judges will put a Dylan lyric in there or some other attempt at humor.
Well, I've got to be careful, I guess, because I'm still appearing before judges. So I think whatever judges do is fine.
Uh-huh.
I like everything judges do.
So I'm old enough to remember when the cartoon caption contest started. In earnest, as you chronicle in the book, there were versions of it. And I originally hated it and thought it was antithetical to the art of cartooning. But over the years, I've got to say, many of them make me laugh. And my kids love it and they play along, so I'm glad they exist. But take us through your opinion of the institution of the caption contest.
Well, yeah, it's a surprisingly controversial topic. A lot of people, including some really wonderful New Yorker cartoonists, just hate it. Sam Gross was one of my favorite New Yorker cartoonists, and he died last year. And his obituary in the New York Times mentioned how much he hated the caption contest. And
he
once said in an interview that he didn't want some dentist in Toledo captioning his work. Mm-hmm. And then I think he was the one who was most hostile to the idea. But you've got other wonderful cartoonists like Roz Chast, whose work would never appear in the contest because it's not really appropriate for it. Because she has such
it's long stories of frazzled, neurotic New Yorkers that is very doing something not universally lending itself to interpretation. Yes,
exactly. And she's never in the contest, but she's on the record as saying that it bothers her. And then there are these cartoonists who are in the contest regularly. Their work appears as a captionless drawing. Who do it just for the money. They don't like it. They don't think that the winning captions are funny. But then, and this was one of the nice things about reading the book, is I got to talk to a lot of New Yorker cartoonists who disagree, and they really like the contest. And some of them will even say, I was struggling with this drawing forever. You know, I put it in the contest, and the winning caption was perfect. It was exactly what my drawing needed, and I never would have thought of that.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes humor is... It's very alchemaic and it's subliminal, and a person might know that we call it a sense of humor, and they might know there's something funny there, but they don't know exactly what the punchline is. This happens with comics all the time. And so I can understand the circumstances where a totally fresh outside perspective actually clarifies in a way that the cartoonist never intended. And you have examples in the book where the cartoonist says, this one's better than my caption. But then you also have examples where it's a pretty great caption and the cartoonist said, no, mine's better. And I want to talk about and debate some of those for sure. But you also said that many of the cartoonists who don't object like the paycheck, you know, because it is one more. How many slots are there for cartoons in the average edition of The New Yorker?
I'd say anywhere from 7 to 20.
Right. And there are how many submissions that make the cut from 7 to 20?
They're pulling from probably 1,000 submissions.
Right. So these are lower than Stanford admission chances. And if you get in, if you're allowed in to go to night school, which or whatever the equivalent is, the feeder campus, you do it because you're a cartoonist and at least your drawing, if not your caption, is welcomed into The New Yorker. I mean, is that fair? Is this just an exploitation? You work for legal action. Is this somewhat an exploitation of the cartoonists? They're not going to object because there's almost no way to get into The New Yorker. But if it was stand-up comedy and the contest was you provide the setup and we'll let the public provide the punchline, I don't know how much they'd like it. But if there was only one comedy club in America, they might have to deal with it.
Yeah, that's a good point. you get paid, as I understand it, you get paid as much for a drawing that's used in the contest as you do for a regular cartoon. And so that's hard to turn down if you're a cartoonist, because it's so hard to make a living as a cartoonist. You know, there are people like Roz Chast who do really well because she's so well known and she illustrates a lot of books. But a lot of cartoonists are teaching and writing graphic novels and submitting cartoons to the New Yorker, and they're trying to cobble together a living. So if the New Yorker is willing to pay you, let's say, $1,500 for a captionless drawing, how are you going to turn that down?
Right.
But I don't know that it's exploitative, because I think there are cartoonists who really like it.
So here's a cartoon. Let's debate this one. A man is hosing down what would be a car in his front yard, but it's actually an electric toaster. And he's talking to his neighbor across the fence. So imagine this suburban scene of a man hosing down his Honda, but it's not a Honda. It's a plug-in toaster. And the original line of the cartoonist, Tom Chaney, was, "Believe me, I regretted it the moment I drove it off the lot." Okay, I think that's pretty freaking great. The cartoon that won from the public is, "It's unplugged. I'm not an idiot." Which is better and why?
Well, the winning caption is better because it's mine. That's the first reason. And I really hesitate to criticize Tom Chaney, whose work I love. But
he's like a judge, I guess.
I do think there was a problem with his original caption, because it presumes that the guy who's hosing off the toaster could actually drive it. And cartoon logic is not as rigid as regular logic, but that defies even cartoon logic. It just doesn't make sense. It goes beyond the parameters that the cartoon is setting up. And my caption did not. It went in a completely different direction. So,
right.
You know, God, I hope Tom Chaney is not listening to this.
Yeah, he would hang down your head, Tom Chaney. Now, I think I like his original better, but I like yours. Yours is tighter in terms of the logic. Let's pick it apart, and there are podcasts that do this. It's unplugged, I'm not an idiot. Why is that better than I'm not an idiot, it's unplugged? Shouldn't the punchline be the last thing?
Well, yes, the punchline should always come last, but I would argue that idiot is the punchline, not unplugged.
Okay.
You know, he's trying to explain why it's okay for him to be hosing down this electric appliance. And he's saying, you know, it's unplugged. And then "I'm not an idiot" works, I think, because he is an idiot. And, you know, and that's the joke. You know, he's saying, "I'm not an idiot."
Yes.
And obviously he's a big idiot.
Yes. Yes. So in the original, the backstory, which I don't think defies at least my logic, I provide this in my head, I do it instantaneously.
Right.
Is that this guy mistook a car for a toaster, or a toaster for a car, like in that Oliver Sacks book. And then you ask yourself, what are all the implications of that? He couldn't have driven it off the lot. That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
But it's wild and funny, like the joke about my spouse thinks he's a chicken and I would object, but for all the eggs. Like,
right,
that
exactly.
Kind of doesn't make sense either, except it's hilarious and it does make sense. What your caption does, and it's a great caption, I'm sure it deserved to win, but it takes away the idea that this ever was a car, or that he's even mistaking it for a car. He's committing the act of washing a toaster in a really stupid way,
exactly.
In a way that is in the same physical location that one washes a car. But there's nothing that would suggest that he thought the toaster was a car,
that's
which
right.
Would make him a bit more of an idiot than you even posit.
Here's the issue, and this comes up a lot in the contest. There's the issue of whether a caption has to make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you read Tom Chaney's cartoon or original caption, it makes you laugh. And there are people who will say, well, then it's good and it works, okay? But if you start to think about it, you start to think, wait, that doesn't really make sense. And I think a really good caption should not give you cause to go back and say, wait a minute, does that make sense in the context of the drawing? But there are plenty of people who will say, if you look at a cartoon and the caption makes you laugh, it made you laugh, so it works.
Right. Winning captions, you write about this, but this is what my resentment of the captions were. So many winning captions, or actually this is probably more typical of the first and second runner-up, fall under the category of, well, that explains it.
Yes.
Because the way we read a cartoon is looking at the picture. I'm like, what the hell is going on?
That's
and the caption that resolves our cognitive dissonance is rewarded. But you know, I think humor is, I'm going to use a word that is used a lot and I hate, orthogonal to actually, or great humor, transcendent humor is orthogonal to the that explains it method. And I think that so many of the cartoon caption contest winners will never be that gut laugh, I didn't expect that, out of left field. It could be, and this, and you get to this and the difference between clever and funny, but I do think, and not so much with your captions, the ones that won, but so many captions, that explains it, is fine and serviceable, but it's less likely to have a transcendent experience than the what comes from the minds of the cartoonists in general.
Absolutely, I agree. And I don't know what orthogonal means, but
me neither. But I think it applies.
It may. I have no idea.
I think it's just a fancy way of saying diagonal or tangential, or yeah.
But the caption contest is a comic puzzle, okay, and it's asking you to solve the riddle. And most of the drawings that appear in the contest have two disparate frames of reference. So you've got to connect them as cleverly as you can. And you're right. The problem is that many of the finalists and some of the winners do nothing more than solve the puzzle. Okay, so you think, well, that's clever. I wouldn't have thought of that. That's a good way to reconcile these disparate elements. But it doesn't make you laugh. So it's not really a successful gag cartoon. So the best winners, I think, both solve the puzzle and make you laugh. And those are somewhat rare, but they do exist. And there are some winning captions in the contest, not mine, I state to add, that make me laugh out loud. What you will not get out of the contest is the kind of cartoon that the New Yorker would want to buy for the inside part of the magazine.
Yeah.
And Drew Dernovich, who's a great New Yorker cartoonist, makes this point. He said, look, many of the winning captions are clever and funny, but they're not meaningful. And he said, that's always the goal. And very often the cartoons that you see, the regular cartoons in the magazine, are clever and funny and meaningful. They make you think. Some of them are profound. And you're not going to get that out of the contest. The most you can hope for is clever and funny.
So give me an example of a meaningful cartoon from the New Yorker.
Well, the one that I think about now a lot because I'm 61 is a Roz Chast cartoon, and it shows a man reading the obituaries, okay? And you can see over his shoulder the headlines, and the headlines read, 5 years younger than you, 2 years older than you, your age exactly. And that's a very profound cartoon, I think, because it's about our fear of death and how people my age do read the obituaries. You know, I remember reading James Gandolfini's obituary, and I think we're almost exactly the same age. And when he died, it was a tragedy just because such a wonderful person and actor. But he also died too young, and we were kind of the same body type. And I got really nervous. And I thought, oh, this is not good for me. And then, and maybe this is inappropriate to mention, but I think in the obituary, it mentioned that he had at one point in his life a problem with cocaine. And I thought, oh, okay, that's it. That's probably what killed him. And I've never used cocaine, so I don't have to worry.
Yeah. This is a great one. And we could have another debate if the original caption is submitted by the cartoonist is better than the public submission. So we have a pigeon and a rat standing next to each other on a ledge of a tall building. And the pigeon is looking on, and the rat has strapped makeshift wings to his little rat arms and is talking as he's clearly about to propel himself off the side of the building. Now, the winning caption is, I told your parents I would convert. And right. That wins because it solves the puzzle, right? Why would a rat put wings on his arms and be talking to a pigeon. So that's a great solve, right?
And it also, it ends on the punchline, as it should, and there are no wasted words. Yeah.
No wasted words. Right. The original line by Ellis Rosen, who in other, I think on the next page, admits that the public out-captioned him on one of his great cartoons, actually. Yeah. But Ellis Rosen, in this case, says he likes his original line better, which was, "I must, Lucille. It's the only way your father will let us marry."
Yeah.
Now, those are technically wasted words, but as Ellis says, the winning caption is snappier than mine, so I can understand why some people prefer it. But I like my version. I like the name Lucille and the melodramatic language, which sets the scene and builds a richer narrative. I have to agree with all his points. And yet I have to say that if his original caption were submitted versus the one that did win, I told your parents I would convert. I told your parents I would convert would definitely win, right?
Yeah, probably. But here's what I want to say. Ellis's original caption is longer, but there are no wasted words.
Okay, good.
And that's the other thing people have to understand. Most of the best captions, I think, are pretty short. They're concise. But some great captions are long, and that's fine as long as there are no wasted words. And there are none in Ellis's caption. And I agree with Ellis. I like his version better.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about your process and then the product. How'd you crack the code of having so many successfully accepted caption contest winners?
Well, it took a long time. I mean, I didn't win until about 2 years after the caption contest became a weekly event. I entered every week, and that's one key to winning, is perseverance. You know, there are some common mistakes that people make. The most common one is that they misidentify the character who's speaking.
Right.
And they submit a caption that would be great if you just had a different character in the cartoon.
Can it be so great that they go back and redraw who's speaking as an asterisk?
I think that happens when cartoonists are submitting cartoons to the cartoon editor, who will sometimes call them up and say, you know, this would work better. You know, there's a lot of editing that sometimes goes on, especially when Bob Mankoff was the cartoon editor. He would talk about how he was trying to work with the cartoonists to have them improve cartoons that he was rejecting. You know, another common mistake that I've made is that people completely misinterpret what's happening in the cartoon. You know, I did this embarrassingly, but I talk about it in the book. When there was a Sam Hurt drawing of a man who was talking to his wife while he's accepting a plate of lemons from the Grim Reaper.
Yes.
And so you've got to connect death to lemons, which the winning caption did. But I don't know how I did this. I thought that the lemons were scones, okay? That the man was accepting a plate full of nice warm scones. And so I came up with five captions that made no sense. And what I will do when I come up with a number of captions, I'm trying to figure out which one to submit, is I'll send them to a few friends who I trust and get their feedback. One of my friends said, you know, this is, these are ridiculous and they don't make sense. And it's lemons, not scones. And then he said he was going to submit as his caption, "Let's give these to Larry Wood and tell him they're scones."
That's good.
Which is a caption that made me laugh out loud. You know, I'll just mention one other piece of advice. Do not use an exclamation point unless it's absolutely necessary.
Well, and another good one is gonna and shoulda. There are some very clear pieces of advice that I never thought of that will probably each up your chances 5%. So this book is worth it, just based on that alone.
Thank you.
Lawrence Wood is the 8-time winner of the New Yorker Cartoon Caption Contest, and his book is Your Caption Has Been Selected. More than anyone could possibly want to know about the New Yorker Cartoon Caption Contest. Lawrence, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Mike. It was a real pleasure.
And now the spiel. The Israeli Defense Forces conducted a daring and successful mission in rescuing four hostages held by civilian families in Gaza over the weekend. Successful from the Israelis' perspective and the Biden administration's. It is difficult, bordering on impossible, to extract hostages from a dense, hostile, fortified urban setting. But freeing hostages is one of the main reasons there is a war in Gaza, one of the main reasons why tens of thousands have been killed. That the Israelis pulled off this operation actually offers more hope, rather than less, that the entire war could end soon. But it is war, and the costs of war are high. Many in the media passed along figures that they could not confirm, but should have every reason to doubt.
Tearful reunions after four hostages held by Hamas for 8 months were finally returned to their families.
Thank you for bringing my son to me, to us.
But the bold operation, aided by U.S. intelligence, came at a high cost of more than 200 Palestinian lives.
274. That should always be attributed to the Hamas Ministry of Health, which has been generally accurate in decades past in accounting for the overall death toll of entire conflicts. That is true. But in this conflict, has been caught out with inaccurate figures that slant towards overreporting the deaths of women and children and also massively inflate specific incidents. Remember the explosion at Al-Hali Arab Hospital, which was initially blamed on Israelis? But now the consensus, even among Israel critical aid groups like Human Rights Watch, is that it came from a misfired rocket launched by Hamas or Islamic Jihad. But the number the Hamas Ministry of Health put out at the time was 471. No other figures come close. Plenty tried to estimate. The hospital itself, which has no incentive to lie, said 200 people were killed. U.S. intelligence offered a wide range between 100 and 300, still off by hundreds. I've seen press reports that put the number in the dozens. With this weekend's raid, however, headlines in every news outlet I could find had at least one reference to 274 or, quote, hundreds without attribution to Hamas. Now, I understand in a headline you can't have all your sourcing present, but you can say Hamas claims death toll in the low hundreds. But even with that death toll, it's an undifferentiated number. I think it scans when you hear it, 274 civilians. That's how it reads when you hear reported 274 Palestinians killed. It doesn't say the Hamas number. It never says civilians and combatants. It just says Palestinians killed or Gazans killed. But this was a raid where Israeli forces were under fire and exchanging fire. They were under so much fire, a member of their force was killed. Someone shot him. Someone was pinning the IDF down with gunfire and RPG fire. Hamas or like-minded combatants fired onto the IDF forces with rockets, small arms, and mortars. Mortars are extremely inaccurate. How many civilians died by Hamas fire? How many civilians who died really were civilians, but were civilians holding the hostages for Hamas? There's no answer to any of this, except to note that this isn't some international conflict trolley problem where a philosopher asks you to flip a switch and doom a dozen to save a loved one. The trolley problem, if you've heard of it, relies on the numbers being real, not vaporous. Otherwise, it becomes an exercise in epistemology, not moral reasoning. The number, even if qualified as originating from Hamas, does begin to anchor itself into our brains and act like a real number through such techniques as repetition, asking questions of the number as if it were real, and that kind of makes it real. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was on This Week. Host Martha Raddatz peppered him with the question over and over again.
The Hamas-run Gaza Ministry of Health says that hundreds were killed. More than 200 were killed. Do you think...
But let's go back to those numbers. The Palestinians say more than 200. The Israelis...
Jake, we're talking about this specific operation, please. Can we talk about this specific operation? Are you not concerned with either of those numbers, whether it's 100.
So does the U.S. support Israel doing more operations like this in the very same way, even if this number of civilians were killed?
And I respect Martha Raddatz. I respect Margaret Brennan, who you heard earlier on the Face the Nation clip. It's not wrong for a U.S. official to have to answer this question. But you know what? He did answer it every time. He didn't dodge it. How concerning? It was asked. Very concerning, was the answer. And it's an appropriate answer, because it is. Of course Palestinian lives matter, and of course there certainly were very many innocents who died. And even if we don't know how many, that's important to note. I'm not taking on faith that Israel is doing everything it can to absolutely minimize such deaths. But the 274 number, an almost certainly inflated number, and why wouldn't it be inflated? What incentive does Hamas have to issue a conservative estimate? 274 doesn't mean that Israel must have acted excessively or immorally. I think the human rights community, or lots of people who are retweeting posts by the human rights community, would have you believe that 274 is all you need to know. 274 to 4, commence your moral calculations. But that's entirely unfair, because we don't know much about the 274. We do know about the 4. We do know why the 4 were there. We can answer the question of the 4. Were they combatants? Were they supportive of Hamas? Were they killed by Hamas? Were their deaths inevitable? No, 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 and no. We do not have the answer for any of the supposed 274. But what I want to emphasize is this isn't about the numbers. Everything that I think about this would be true if the 274 were real and if the majority, the vast majority of them, were truly innocent civilians. Because we're not going to math our way to clarity. But just consider this. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Human Affairs, there were 23,074 reported deaths between October 7th and January 7th, an average of 250 a day. This is the calculation of the first 100 days, which were claimed to be inaccurately the bloodiest of this century. But 250 a day. So during that time, when we saw 23,000 people die, there was only one hostage rescued. There were two rescued a month after that calculation ended. What I'm saying is, in this latest operation, representing a supposed conundrum pitting 4 hostages versus 274 Palestinian lives, it's a bizarre question to ask at this time, given that there were 100 days and maybe more of the war with as many deaths and no successes. I'll help make this point by answering one of the questions that Martha Raddatz peppered Jake Sullivan with.
But let's go back to those numbers. The Palestinians say more than 200. The Israelis say not more than 100. That is a lot of people to be killed in a rescue operation. Again, does that number concern you?
Well, every single
answer. Well, of course it does, Martha. But note that that number the Israelis quoted would mean a rescued hostage for every 25 Palestinians killed, putting aside which 25 Palestinians and how many of them were firing at the Israelis first. If that were the ratio from the beginning of the war, we'd have a situation today where all the hostages would be freed at a death toll of 85% less than the actual death toll. Even at the higher Hamas number, the 274, you're asking me, would I possibly accept a condition where all the hostages were freed, but the death toll would be less than half of what the death toll is? Now, of course, it's only a hypothetical to sign up for that, and who wouldn't, knowing what we know as an alternative to what we've lived through. And it's only a hypothetical, not just because it's very, very hard to rescue hostages, but it's impossible to rescue them. Hamas killed scores of hostages immediately or since capture. But it is weird and it is telling that those engaged in the pretty straightforward exercise of curing a successful hostage rescue operation have been put on the back foot and made to defend that success in the way they've been. And it's because of this. Israel can't have a victory, can't be allowed to have a success. Israel must always take blame, even on a day when world opinion should center on the unbelievable inhumanity Hamas showed in kidnapping civilians and embedding them with other civilians in order to maximize the death of civilians. It's exactly what Hamas wants. Israel's methods are always wrong, never excusable, and also never successful. The phrase that set off so many was Jake Sullivan's official White House statement. Quote, today, Israeli security forces conducted a successful operation. Underpinning so much of the debate, even at the onset of the war, was the idea that it was impossible to defeat Hamas. A fool's errand, exactly what Hamas wants Israel to think. Very little in that line of argumentation was spent on the question of rescuing hostages. Just hope, I guess, that the terrorist organization that spent years and billions preparing for a subterranean battle designed to do exactly what it's done, i.e. kill civilians, just hope they decide to give the hostages back. You know, in pursuit of terrorists, though thankfully not having to rescue hostages, the United States has waged wars in which more civilians have been killed than in a dozen Gaza wars. On its way to kill ISIS head Abu Bakr el-Baghdadi, special forces pumped bullets into a van driven by an entirely innocent group of Syrians. Two died, one had to have an arm amputated. During that raid, two children died. Now, al-Baghdadi blew them up. They were his children. But if this were, say, an ISIS Ministry of Health report, they would just show up as civilians and civilians under the age of 12. How dare us, the Americans? I do think every country in the world that could have pulled off this weekend's raid would have. Now, there are a few that could. And among those that could, who would say, we're not going to, for fear of collateral damage? What commitment does that have of any country to its own citizens compared to a commitment to the citizens of a hostile state or to the world's opinions? The blowback we see is, I'm crediting it, I'm not saying it's concocted, it's part real anguish at the dead and part a steady campaign of members of the international community deciding that Israel will always be in the wrong, even, I'd say, especially when they get an operation right. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Leon Baum's our intern. Hello, Baum. Michelle Pesca is in charge of intern orientation for Peachfish Productions. To advertise, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperuji Peru, do Peru, and thanks for listening.